On October 24, 2007, veteran journalist Seymour Hirsch delivered the Amnesty International annual lecture in Dublin, Ireland. Hirsch is renowned for his work reporting the My Lai massacre of Vietnamese villagers by U.S. troops in 1968, and more recently, the photo gallery of torture in the American-run Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad, Iraq. In this speech, Seymour Hirsch reveals a portrait of madness in the Bush White House, leading toward yet another war, this time with Iran. This speech has been edited for a one-hour radio show. Here is Seymour Hirsch.
I do agree. Critical thinking, if you get that out of here, you're on your way. That's about it. I mean, you're right. Critical thinking. That's what we need. We don't get enough of it. I'm going to watch the clock, and we'll try and get out of here in a reasonable time, but I'll just tell you what's just to set the groundwork and just let you know where we're at. Let me give you the bad news. The bad news is, by my count, there's 453 days left in the reign of King George II. The good news is that when we wake up tomorrow morning, there'll be one less day. And short of that, folks, you got it. Not much else good news. So this is not going to be a happy hour here for you. And so you're as happy as you're going to get. I don't want to overdo it, but on different days I have different thoughts. I've just come back from the Middle East, and I'm you know, plain boy reporter and chasing stuff. And I can tell you that we could well be on the verge of a major war between the West and the Muslim world. It doesn't have to happen. I'm not sure that the people in Washington who make the decisions, the president and the vice president, I don't think you can separate them, Dick Cheney and George Bush, I'm not sure they really understand or want to understand what's going on. They have their version of the world, which I basically call science fiction. We have a president, this is a grown man, runs a major country, and there are people he doesn't like. He doesn't like Hamas, he doesn't like Hezbollah, he doesn't like the Syrians, and he doesn't like the Iranians, and therefore he doesn't talk to them. And that's not considered to be very unusual by my colleagues in the government, in the Congress, and in the press. We have a president that doesn't talk to people he doesn't like. And it's pretty astonishing. And he has a set of beliefs that are fixed beliefs. And I'll tell you the bottom line for this president. First of all, you have to understand something about this president. He believes what he says. When you hear them talking, as they've been quite a bit lately, talking about the threat that the Iranians are posing to our troops and the coalition forces, that is the British forces, what's left of them, in Iraq, I think they believe it. I think this president went to war with Saddam Hussein, believing, somehow he became convinced that after 9/11, after Osama bin Laden, this fanatical, marginal jihadist who had not generated very much support at all among the Muslim world. After 9/11, and we were scared and frightened, and collectively we weren't used to terrorism like people here are, or at least you have a history of terrorism. We don't have much of a history. And we wanted, again, as I say, fear is very, very powerful in all of these issues. In any case, no question, he wanted to go after, do Afghanistan. We can argue that the merits of that, but everybody can understand the Taliban were supporting bin Laden. I don't think there's any question bin Laden was responsible. But somehow to get from Afghanistan, whatever the questions are about the origins of that war, and we can discuss that, but that's less of a case. He somehow concluded that the path from Afghanistan led through, in terms of fighting jihadism, religious fanaticism led to Baghdad, a country that, if anything, has been secular. And Saddam, there's no brief for Saddam, although I assure you he'd be welcomed by many, many people in Iraq today. I don't think there's any question about that, as awful as he was. Saddam was fanatic and unbelievably unrelenting towards any jihadism, just as they have been in Syria, too. They're very tough. In the case of the Syrians, it would be the Muslim Brotherhood, etc. So the Ba'ath Party in general. So I don't how this president reached that conclusion. You can talk about neocons and neoconservatives, and I'll give you my nickel dime definition, really simply, of that, which is that after Russia fell, and the wall fell in 1991. A number of Americans who worked in the Pentagon at the time, including Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz, sort of the infamous Paul Wolfowitz, who came to no good at the World Bank and wasn't much good as Deputy Secretary of Defense either. But they decided, and this is the core, I think, of neoconservatism, which is that we are now top dog. No other country is going to get to a position where they can threaten us. We are going to stay the top dog. And number one on the hit list from the very beginning was Saddam. I could give you a million collateral reasons, because of Israel, of course, because of oil. But also they just, Saddam was, and I can also say that they didn't, many of them were very disappointed that we didn't move in 91, that George Bush the first in 91 didn't go to Baghdad and get rid of him. We had a coalition, if you remember. We really had a very active coalition in 91. Much of the Arab world was with us on that war. And in any case, so that was the thinking. It generated a lot of, it was always Kookland, you know, La La Land. In the 90s, they would do an occasional paper with the Israelis about how Iraq's the focal threat. And just how we got from being concerned in the fall of 2001 by Osama bin Laden, and how we got from there that the next step was to do Iraq, will be the stuff of historians. Although I will tell you, it's not clear that there'll be much history. I have a friend, a senior American officer, and I'm long of tooth. It's not that difficult to understand why I would have friends. You know, I was covering the Pentagon as an associate for the wire services in the 60s in the Vietnam War, and you get to know people. And people are people. You get to maintain friendships. One of my friends did a private study a year ago on Afghanistan, about which I'll talk briefly, but, you know, down the tubes. And he did it for the ranking general, American general, who was then running NATO. And he was telling me about it one morning early at breakfast after he came back and giving me what he reported. And I asked him, I said, when did you have time to write that report? Because he was doing so many other things. He was an active general. And he said, looked at me and he said, write a report, Cy, write a report, oral. I give it to him orally. And so I don't think the historians of the next 50 years or 100 years are really going to be able to answer this question. Essentially, how did we get from one place to the other? I'll put it another way. How did, after 9/11, did eight or nine neoconservatives take over the government? How was America so easily taken over by what I call a cult? And I mean it half seriously, more seriously than you might think, a cult of like-minded people. Rumsfeld eventually became a neocon. I think Cheney was much more neoconservative than people believe, but certainly Reagan wasn't. I mean, not Reagan, Bush. Bush was not. The Wolfowitz was, and Pearl was, and Doug Feist, some of these other names were dyed in the wool. A guy you never heard of, Bill Luti. I. Lewis Libby, Scooter Libby we call him, who was put in jail for his activities against Valerie Plame, the fellow who wrote about the alleged uranium, but the former ambassador, Joe Wilson. All of these people were dyed in the wool, hardliner neocons, but how did they do it? Great mystery. And what it does say, in a sort of a profound way, is how fragile the American democracy is, that this group can come in with ideas that are absolutely off the wall, science fiction, if you will, and overwhelm the military, which stayed mute, overwhelm the Congress, which on any given day, my Congress for the last 6 years has either taken your choice supine or prone, but they're down. They've been there, not doing anything. Overcome the bureaucracy. We have a vibrant federal bureaucracy that often, like any bureaucracy, is really quick to leak and tell you things that they think are wrong, and overcome my colleagues in the press. And I always was reluctant for years. The first few years after 9/11, until Bush's re-election, I was reluctant to, I was on the case against him right away in the New Yorker, but I was reluctant to complain about my colleagues because I thought it was, among other things, self-serving. I just didn't want to go to war with them. But I got to tell you, in America, the Constitution is unfettered. The First Amendment says unfettered right And basically, the way it works, it's more complicated here. You know what's going on with the Irish Times. It's much, the legal situation is different here. Basically, the way it works in America is, I used to go to the war colleges and tell the generals, the budding young generals, this, and we'd get tremendous rows. I say, look, it's your job to keep it secret. But under the Constitution of the United States, it's my job to find it out. And once I find it out, there's no bar to publishing. None. Except my judgment, or my editor's judgment. Any secret I can get my hands on, I can publish. And there's just no bar. You can't put me in jail. That's the way it is, folks. And essentially, that is the way it is. But my press, my colleagues in the press, frankly, missed the most important moral story of this decade, which is the amazingly wrongheaded and misleading road to path in Iraq, which has started so much trouble and which is not over yet. And so it's such a bleak story. What makes it particularly bleak is I do think George Bush believes what he says. I think he believed there was WMD, although there were many people in the government who could have told him otherwise. I think he still believes it's viable. I think he still thinks he can pull it out. And in the beginning, when they planned the war, they literally, in the early debates, they thought they could do this on the cheap. I don't mean because financially on the cheap. They thought, oh, a few thousand, 5,000, 10,000 special troops, special forces, some airplanes, drop a few hundred thousand leaflets and American flags all over the place, and Saddam would fall very easily. And then democracy would spread. I was saying this earlier to a journalist, would spread like water throughout Iraq. And democracy then would wash its way into Iran and Lebanon and Syria. And it would be just wonderful. You'd change the world. You'd make it safer from Israel, which is always important. You'd get a much better hold on the 40% of the world's oil is there. And everything would be happy. And they believe they could do it. What can I tell you? And this president, as I said, still thinks it's winnable. Do you remember the way I first began to figure out how crazy it was? From the outside, I just thought, I know this president really is fascinated by democracy. The Indians have told me that when I was in Delhi and some senior Indians were trying to explain Bush to me as they saw it. And they had gone, when he was governor of Texas, they had gone on a trade mission in 98 to Austin, Texas, the capital of Texas, and they visited Bush. They were, whether it was cotton or rice, whatever the business was. And Bush just went on and on about, you're the greatest democracy, I'm so much in love with democracy, which I find really interesting because I do think that's where he is. what we have with this president is the most radical president we've ever had. He's an absolutely unguided missile. He truly is, as I've often said, he wouldn't know the reference, but he's a true Trotskyite. He's a believer in permanent revolution. He really does. He's unguided in the sense he's completely uneducable. You cannot shake him out of anything. He believes what he believes. He thinks that the solution to Iraq is now Iran, which is really terrifying. But in any case, the way I got a glimpse at this is about a month before the war began in Iraq, in the February of 2003, after the buildup, and after all this sort of balderdash about we're going to negotiate with through the UN. We're in the same sort of posture now. We're going to negotiate with the Iranians about uranium, about enriching uranium. Same sort of garbage that's being spread around today, when ultimately its violence is probably going to be the result, may not be. But in that case, he pretty much made up his mind, we now know from various anecdotal accounts of other people. But about a month before the war, Wolfowitz testified about how few troops would be needed. And then the head of the army, a general named Shinseki, testified, well, actually, he told one of the Armed Services Committee of the Senate, it'll be 200,000 to 300,000 troops should be there at the minimum. And, of course, there was just hue and cry. Wolfowitz immediately denounced him. And Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, had one more. You served 4 years as chief of staff, the senior member of the army. Rumsfeld, he had a year left to serve. Rumsfeld immediately announced his replacement. Announced that he was going to be replaced by another general. A year before, it was just as an insult, just as a punishment for saying what he said. And so somebody who was one of the neocons, who I know, was explaining what it was, and he said, you have to understand. He said this sympathetically. He said, it wasn't that Shinseki challenged the numbers. It wasn't that. Didn't he come to all those meetings? They would meet in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, have a sealed room, lead-free room called the tank, where the president would meet before war and for war games. He'd been to all those meetings at the tank. He'd heard us explain time and time again why we only need 10 or 20,000 troops at the most. That he's going to fall. We've got a new government in place. We've been working with everybody. There's going to be no et cetera, et cetera. It was as if you remember the cult business, there used to be something called, it was certainly in America, deprogrammers. They would come and grab your children out of a cult and deprogram. It was as if he said he'd been deprogrammed. He'd been seeing, that somehow he'd gotten deprogrammed, the general. That was the concern. It wasn't that he had different numbers, is that he wasn't a believer. How could he not be a believer? How could he say that? And you began to see how insular, I did anyway, and look, I would go home and moan into my pillow about it because it seemed so off the wall. Okay. The other thing, by the way, they haven't told you. I don't know why people don't always say things, but one of the things we do know is that they, for some reason, the government hasn't talked about it. It's not really relevant, but we now know after the war, we got through many files, as you know, and we know that Saddam Hussein did plan for the insurrection, that he set up a very complicated three-tier level of cells operating on... his opposition was the Dawa Party, which is out of Iran. And these were Iraqis who were trained in Iran. Most of the leadership of the Shiite government now spent the war in Iran. There's a tremendous tie there, which is another contradiction. The only people that attempted to kill him or took action against him or his children were the Dawa Party, and Saddam would arrest these people. And they never knew more. They would torture them and get the names of everybody they knew, but there was only two or three people. So Saddam emulated that in his planning. A general named Dowry, who's still alive and has not been captured, ran it. And there's no question that the insurgency that began started before he had planned for it. That doesn't mean that disbanding the army, I assume all of you know all this history, that we disbanded the army, we disbanded the Ba'ath Party. In effect, what we decided to do, the neocons, was to turn the government. We were great believers in democracy. The largest population in the country was the Shia. We turned it over to the Shia. And at the time, there were arguments, there were people in the intelligence community, I'm talking about April, May, June of 03, after we seemingly won the war, who said the problem with turning it over to the Shia is that they are very close to the Iranians, because Iran was the only, Saddam was horrible to the, always had his foot on their neck, as I've said many times, of the Shia when he was in power, and the Iranians always kept the support of their fellow Shia across the border, even though they fought a war together, an eight-year war in 1980 to 88 between Iran and Iraq, in which a lot of Shia on both sides died. But the intelligence people would tell the neocons that this isn't such a good idea because they're eventually going to support Iran. And the neocons said, no. They'll be their state loyalty. They will be ultimately loyal to Iraq. And, of course, they were wrong, like they're wrong in so many things. And, of course, with horrific consequences, many of the come. And so we have an unguided president in the sense that he's uneducable. I do mean that. You can't change him off his view, who has deeply fixed views, that still thinks he's right. That isn't to say he realizes, he talks privately about Churchill a lot, and what he says is this, that I wouldn't say he's terribly sophisticated, but he's not stupid. And you have to remember that, he's not stupid. You couldn't get to where he is without being, he's not stupid. Churchill, as many of you know, after World War II, when everybody came home for the war, they wanted jobs, they were worried about security, they voted Labour. His party was voted out in 46, and he came back, in 52? And so Bush says, nobody will appreciate me now. They don't know what I'm doing. But in 20 years, when this works, and we've changed the Middle East, he says that even now, they will understand. It may take two decades. At one point, Condoleezza Rice, in a trip to Australia, said something like 50 years, she said. And really, about 2 years ago, she said it might be 50 years before we're appreciated. But he does believe that. And here's what they ultimately believe when you really get down to it. And here's where the word science fiction really gets in there. They see what they're doing. And this, I dare say the source is anonymous, which is a funny word to use today in Ireland. But the source is anonymous. I do have people that have information, direct information. and at high risk. They talk about some of it. And at the meetings, at the close meeting, when there's debate, obviously, there are people, the military are panicked about going to Iran. And many of the Congress are panicked about it. And what they say is this. There is no intelligence that Iran has a bomb, none whatsoever. And we did, about 3 years ago, we did a major covert operation, probably an awful lot with the Israelis, and with Baluchis and Azeris and Kurds. We buy off all sorts of fringe elements and various border areas, and they work with us. And we did an immense amount of work, very sophisticated. If they were looking for, I don't know if any of you have seen that wonderful Woody Allen movie, I think it was Bananas, where there's little people running around, robots underground. They were looking for a underground, what we believe was a parallel weapons program that Iran was running. Yes, there was the one they had declared to the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. We were convinced that they had a secret program in which they were doing more than just research on enriching uranium. They were fabricating a warhead, which is very difficult, and doing the various testing in order to explode a nuclear device. And so we did things like, oh, God, what can I tell you about it? I'm a good American, and I don't like to get into operational stuff. And I work, even though I'm blackballed by the administration, I'm not blackballed by some people in there. And I always make sure I vet my stories with various people. One of the things I can tell you is, for example, if there was a building in the mountains or an area in the mountains where there's some building we looked at and we wondered if something was going on there, we could drop pebbles that cost a fortune each, that were able to, in the roadways, and we would be able to measure the weight of trucks going into the building and coming out to see whether they were bringing stuff into what we thought was an underground facility. And of course, and we could, if there was a building in Tehran, we had ways of finding out whether there was any radioactive emissions, any research there. And the answer was null, nothing. What you got is what you say. But for the White House, it doesn't matter. What Bush and Cheney... And this is articulated by Cheney. I don't know what Bush says on this one, but the articulation is this, that we don't care what the community says, that there's no bomb now. We know they want one, and we know that they will get one eventually. And when they do, Hezbollah, the party of God, which was controlled by Hassan Nasrallah in southern Lebanon, the group that just defeated Israel, or the Israelis would say it was a stalemate, but you wouldn't want that kind of a stalemate if you're in a fight. But in any case, it's just words. People use words. This is a president, by the way. I'm in a profession, in an academic setting here. We're all in a setting here where words really mean something. Talk about critical thinking. Words are very important to all of us, and particularly I write, people teach, students learn. And I have a president for which words mean nothing. They're just devices. We don't torture. That's a categorical statement. We don't torture. What does that mean, given Guantanamo? Even given the fact that, as described by what we know about what goes on, the most primitive kind of torture goes on. Yes, there are lawyers in the Justice Department who will rewrite the statute to redefine torture so that what seems to be torture, that is the unbelievable, unrelenting abuse of somebody, doesn't really, in their definition, add up to torture. But nonetheless, he says, I don't torture. We don't torture. It's words, just words. And he's happy saying it. He's content saying it. And how do you cope with that? How do you cope with a president that doesn't care what we write? We're all useless, I have to tell you. Yes, it's great to be here, and it's great. I'm going off in a couple of days to get a literary prize somewhere else in Europe. And I am definitely, it's lonely at the top. I get a lot of prizes and a lot of attention. But the truth is, that I and my colleagues at the New York Times, where I worked for 10 years, and at the Washington Post and at the American networks, which are pretty comical, but that they try sometimes. I don't know. Every time I watch it, I think it's parody. It's one of those old, that was the week that was show or something like that. It's a parody of news, but it's news. Anyway, such as it is, we try, and it doesn't matter what we say. As I said, they're a nerd. They couldn't care less. They've got their agenda. And they believe that when Iran gets the bomb, he's going to give it to Hezbollah. And they believe Hezbollah has underground cells in America and will set off the bomb. They believe that they are protecting us in America from a nuclear weapon maybe one or two decades down the road. That's what they say privately. And, what can you do about it? That's what they believe. Will they or won't they on Iran? I don't know. I'm asked that question all the time. So where are we in this mess? I'll tell you where I think we are. In Afghanistan, we're dead meat. We're gone. It's just a question of time. We can maybe stall it out a year, but the Taliban are coming strong. Now, I'll tell it to you a funny way. I have a friend in the intelligence community, and he's very close to people in Afghanistan, in the CIA station there, what we call COS, Chief of Station. And in the station, or in the community, and they were circulating within the last few months, humor. You know, Ireland is full of black humor, mostly about themselves, but sometimes about England. But the American military is full of black humor. I once saw an email from somebody in the Joint Chiefs of Staff who was writing a memo about the war to his boss and gave me a copy. And the last paragraph was, you know, in golf you have this idea where you, in the first tee, if you don't like the shot, you can take it over again, a mulligan they call it. And he said this boss, he finally wrote a long paper, actually it's pretty interesting, about what Iran could do if it wanted to. And he said, you know what, boss, he said, essentially, he said, I think we should just, why don't we just take a mulligan? Let's just say to the people in Iraq, we're really, really, really sorry we invaded your country. And then bracket, and we really, really, really are sorry, he said. And let's call it a day, you know, and just leave, you know. But anyway, so this memo from the chief of station, this fake memo says, there's a word they use in the close of station or something. There's a phrase they use when a station is shut down under duress and had that title. It wasn't real. But it was, the guys inside wrote it. I'm sure the chief didn't write it. He would be really pissed off about this, I think. But anyway, it said, this is our sign-off station. It's to the headquarters in McLean, Virginia, where the state CIA's headquarters. Sign-off station, we estimate 5 hours left. We're burning our files now. Karzai, the puppet that we continue to assist has something to do with running the government there. He's got control of his compound, maybe a few hundred acres outside, but that's about it. Karzai has been shot by one of his security guards. The Taliban are a few hours away. There was one other regional city nearby that is still holding out, but it's going to fall soon. We estimate that we've ordered the choppers are going to take off with the staff in 5 minutes, and some of our people will try and get them out. And the real purpose of the memo was this. It said on the second page, this is from inside, it said, it isn't that we didn't have a bad idea, that the Taliban were disliked, were unpopular, and that their version of course, towards women, inhumane, and their version of religious law, Islamic law, was so remote and so psychotic as to be unliked by anybody, even in the Pashtun society. But what did it was us. It was our violence. Everywhere we went, we killed recklessly and too much. And everywhere we went, we were hated. After a few weeks, we were welcomed, and then they would turn on us because of how we did it. Using too much air, too much force, constant killing. And you know, every day, just to shift to Iraq for a second, every day, even today, you see the stories. And in the American press, it's 30 insurgents were killed in a mission yesterday. And then you watch Al Jazeera, which Al Jazeera is a taboo word in America, and Al Jazeera English, which is their national newly or sort of organized network, is not permitted. You can't get it. No, every cable handler, whatever the phrase is, any 12-year-old would know, every cable company or every cable system refused to service it. They would not take it. They have absolutely no foothold in America, Al Jazeera. But if you did watch Al Jazeera, you would see that the day after we claimed 30 insurgents were killed, 25 women and children showed up in hospitals. And it's just chronic. And eventually when we get embarrassed, we are now reduced to saying that, yes, civilians were killed because they were put in front of the troops. The insurgents used them against us. The same thing they said in Vietnam, the same thing that's been said in all wars and all time. And, if we kill civilians, it's the fault of the people that we're fighting. That's just chronic. There's, what Milai said to the American people, and they didn't like hearing it, but it was something they couldn't. It was 565 people these boys killed. What Milai said is, we don't fight wars any better than anybody else, and war is just dehumanizing. It's the soldiers. who really don't like war, who talk the most, and it's the politicians, like the men we have running our government now, who have never seen never smelled cordite, as some of my friends say, who think war is okay. But that's always the way it's been. And so in Afghanistan, it's a question of time. The Taliban we were seeing them in forces of 8 to 10. Now we're seeing them in forces of 100. Yes, we are killing some. We bomb. And our special forces, our American special forces with NATO, some of our allies, the Brits in particular, are competent and working well. But it's the numbers are bad. The numbers are growing. And it's just a question of time. You know, by the way, just to show you how ridiculous and the American knowledge is, the Iranians supported the Karzai government until just about a year and a half ago when they realized there was no chance. Why? Because they're Shia. They didn't like the Sunni Taliban. In fact, the Iranians supported us after 9/11. I sealed the border. I mean, you don't need this is all boilerplate, but it is true that the Iranians worked very hard initially with Karzai, and the last thing they wanted to do was have much to do with the Taliban.
You are listening to the award-winning journalist Seymour Hersh giving the 2007 Amnesty International lecture in Dublin, Ireland. The topic, U.S. intentions for Iran and the Middle East.
Let me go to Iraq for a minute because it's the unhappy world tour here. I basically think, of course, what's happened there is sectarian. The American military is very, particularly in Baghdad, what we've done is we wall off Sunnis from Shia. And we're doing that in most of the major urban areas where we have some foothold. We wall them off, and that's how we can say that things are quieter. You heard of the famous surge in Anbar province, the large province to the west of Baghdad, which is traditionally Sunni, and how the surge worked, and we've been running, killing al-Qaeda. And what you don't know about the surge is, yes, things are much better there, much more peaceful. But essentially, anywhere from the numbers I hear, I can't get them resolved, but they're staggering. As many as well over 100,000 Shia have left. You've had ethnic cleansing. The surge, which was initially announced by the president as a way to bring Iraq together, to bring the sides, the surge will work and we'll have peace. He doesn't say that anymore. He just talks about it as a military success. 30,000 troops were added, and we've won a battle, and things are quieter there, which they are. But as I say, over 100,000, perhaps, maybe less, maybe more, are now living in concrete cities and tent cities in Baghdad, which is gradually becoming more and more a Shiite city. The evacuation there is enormous of Sunni. And so, yes, it worked. And just to show you how crazy numbers are, all militaries lie about numbers. There's always in Vietnam, it's what else is new. They always rank the statistics better. That's typical. And we're doing it there in terms of deaths and casualties. I tend to believe that we fly with impunity, we bomb with impunity, we use artillery with impunity. And if you remember Lancet, the British medical journal did a study about 2 years ago saying 650 deaths was their estimate. I didn't look at it in terms of writing about it, but I certainly looked at their statistical methodology, and I asked a bunch of statisticians what they thought of the methodology, and they said they use very prudent, accepted, standard. Any good accounting firm would tell you their methodology was very solid and very prudent. So the estimates were, of course, they could be wrong by a factor, who knows. But estimates were considered to be solid. There's been a new study in the last 6 months that put the number at 950. The number is breathtaking. And there's no question the number of people who have left in Iraq is also breathtaking. I was in Syria. They estimate now 2 million refugees there. 800,000 was the last number I heard inside Jordan. It's probably more. So this is a world, if you remember your history, in 48, when the Israelis won the war and forcibly ejected the Palestinians, many of them came to roost in camps, fetid camps that still exist in Lebanon and Syria, among other places. And that's been one of the great humanitarian crises and political crises of our time, right of return, et cetera, et cetera. And what are we sitting on now? A crisis with actually more numbers, because the numbers were much smaller then. We're talking about 3-4 million people in the diaspora out there, in refugees status. And does anybody talk about it? I've had senior officers in the military tell me they're ashamed of the fact there's been no discussion at all inside as well as outside. So we have another huge humanitarian crisis with consequences that are impossible to calculate, just unbelievable. We've got 3 to 4 million people displaced from their homes. And of course, one rational solution would be, if you were interested in talking to people, interested in being rational, Iran and Syria. There are many refugees in Iran too, many more in Syria. All these countries, border countries, have an enormous interest in stabilizing Iraq. And instead, we're going to see Iraq divided into three, which is going to cause enormous troubles in the Middle East. They view that as simply an Israeli game to weaken them. And I've been talking to Middle East, the bosses, foreign ministers and stuff like that. They are really adamant about this. This country is not going to be divided. And getting back to the surge, I'll just give you some common sense about the surge. You know, there's always the common sense approach to everything. Okay, let's take the president at face value. He added 3,000 troops, and it worked. Anbar province, which was very hot and heavy in terms of terrorism, sectarian violence. Al-Qaeda has always been a marginal issue. There's just one. The real pros on the inside, 2 to 3%. There's no real leadership of the Al-Qaeda. They're just jihadists who come in who want to be car bombers, and they're used by the Sunnis, who don't like them very much and sometimes kill them. And they're not that they're not without some significance, but they're not nearly as significant as been stating. Most of the violence comes Sunni versus Shia, and it's now ritualized. It's now in the core, as in, you know, the former Yugoslavia. You have that kind of, you know, with the Muslims and the Christians, etc. In any case, okay, let's take the president at face value. The surge worked. You've cleared an area, and it's more peaceful. Okay, what does he do? Yeah, a month or so ago, he has a speech in which he announced it's worked, so he's bringing home the troops. Well, the analogy to this would be, we send troops into World War II in the Normandy, in the beaches at Normandy. We land at Normandy, we have some terrific fighting, some beaches go quickly, Omaha goes very badly. But after a few days, we stabilize the beach, and then we start rotating the troops home. How crazy is that? If the surge worked, why not do more of it? Instead, he announces he's returning the troops, which means to me, numbers have nothing to do with anything, which also means to me, speaking heuristically, which, you know, critical thinking, my guess is the Democrats are in for real trouble, because all the president has to do is somehow stagger through the next 6-8 months, which he can do. The Shia are going to stay quiet. As much as they don't like what's going on with the Sunnis, our support for the Sunnis in Anbar province, the Shia have gotten they win the country. They have the country. Iran has won. Iran controls. The Shia are very tight with Iran. The Shia in Iraq are close with the Shia in Iran. I still think there'll be different countries, but it's generally perceived that Iran's the winner of our war because they've extended their influence well into, deep into most of all, southern Iraq. And there's no question they're winners. By most people see it that way. But it seems to me the president can announce, the Democrats are busy going around saying we have to begin withdrawing and start set levels. The one number I heard was 80,000. If I'm the president of the United States, I just let him talk that way. And early in the summer, I announced I'm cutting the troops down to 70,000. We're winning the war, and let's have an election. And he can win it. For one thing, the Republicans stand for something. I happen to think it's unbelievable, intolerable. Not in the best interests of America, but they stand for something. Democrats are all over the place. So there we are. I just give you that scenario. I wouldn't bet on the Democrats for a nickel. I mean, for a minute. I mean, it could not go the way they want, because this president can do anything he wants with numbers, since they don't matter anyway. If he really thought he could do what he did, he would double the surge. Anyway, there we are. Iran. I can tell you right now, the American, about 3 months ago, Bush started. They changed the game. The game was, We had to go be tough with Iran because they're going to get a nuclear bomb, and they tried to spin it, and it didn't work. Internally, it was clear the American people they weren't as frightened as people in the White House about the notion of an Iranian bomb. And the polls show, their internal polling show, and this I know empirically, not very good results. The public didn't buy it. They were in this intractable series of negotiations with the Iranians, with the European Union. Over the enrichment of uranium. And the Iranians have only been, they've been weaving rugs for a couple thousand years, and they've tied us in knots. And Bush's approach to the negotiations anyway, if some of you are following it, Bush's approach is really pretty simple, very primitive. He will not get into direct negotiations with the Iranians about their nuclear enrichment until they stop it. Once they stop it, then he will talk to them about it. That's his position. That is literally, I'm not exaggerating, that is literally his position. Needless to say, the Iranians don't agree, that they think this, they claim they're doing it for peaceful purposes. You can, you know, there's no reason to believe them. I'm sure they would grab a bomb tomorrow if they could, but all the evidence is they haven't been able to. You need 90% enrichment to get to a nuclear weapon. And the last report by the International Atomic Energy of August 30th put there, after a decade of working on this stuff, there are 3.67. And some of my friends who know the Iranians very well said, you know, they're an interesting society. They have these old cars, the Mercedes left over from the days of the Shah, they can't keep running. They have the F-15s we left, they can't keep in the air. They're just not as technically competent as we think. Who knows? I don't know what the truth is. I do know that the Americans, we all have myths about Iran. There's been no representation, no diplomatic recognition for what, since 79. And it's just one science fiction area for us, another science fiction area. Iran, fanatical Iran, controls Hamas, controls Hezbollah, controls Syria, Syria controls Hezbollah, Hezbollah controls Hamas, you name it. There's no independence anywhere in the Arab world in our view. It's all some sort of master stuff. And of course there is an awful lot of support. And we who do everything we can to support our friends don't understand why Iran supports Iraq. We can't, that's unacceptable. Iran can't support Iraq. It's just unacceptable. And so anyway, the study I was telling you about in which the officer said that there's no real, you know, what Iran could do. If the Iranians are, it's so complicated, it's really Iran. But if you say Iran too much in America, they start saying Iran, they correct you. So I don't, I give up. I'll use both. The Iranians have always supported the Shia. And after the, if you remember in 92, after we won Gulf War I, there was a brief revolt that we sort of inspired, but we allowed Saddam to keep his helicopters and he will end up killing everybody. And the only people that provided humanitarian help then to all of southern Iraq were the Iranians, and they still have a long tradition of it. We've arrested something like between January and about July, 500 Iranians. We were arresting everybody we can, and for a long time that was the game this year. And most of them we had to release except for just five or six or seven. Most of them were doing humanitarian stuff or stuff that was easily explained, had nothing to do with warfare. We have not caught anybody with a push cart of guns and rockets coming across the border. We have not captured one Iranian Revolutionary Guard inside the country that was plotting and killing and meant to killing American. There's no empirical evidence that Iran is doing anything different, which has always been supporting their buddies, their fellow Shia with weapons, intelligence, support, but they haven't escalated it. They haven't done anything differently. And yet, and what the paper that I was, the email I was talking about with that funny stuff about the mulligan, what he was talking about, this officer, is what they could do. For example, Iranians have very advanced radar systems and very advanced SAM, surface-to-air missiles that can attack any aircraft. All they have to do if they want to change the ball game in Iraq is give... We've accused Iran at various times of supporting not only the Shia militias, but the Sunni militias. The president's even said they support Al-Qaeda, which is all loony. But if they could give their allies SAM missiles, surface-to-air missiles, we could change the whole war in 1 minute. We would not be able to fly with impunity. We talk a lot about how to get to Baghdad, the airplanes do corkscrews because there's an occasional missile fired. We wouldn't be able to get in. And in this email, the officer who was writing, and what I'm telling you is just, I'm just finding a convenient way to say it, but it's all empirical. The Iranians have very advanced anti-tank missiles. If they were to provide that to the insurgency, we wouldn't have to have the explosive devices on the ground. We could just be taking them on frontally. Our tanks go right through the tanks. So there's so much Iran could do which it isn't doing. You don't hear that. So what is it about? It's about propaganda. It's about the Americans deciding in the White House, sometime probably in May or June, no longer let's push this button. Let's start talking about the Iranians are winning. The Iranians are helping the insurgency to win, and they're killing American boys, and that's been the mantra for 3 or 4 months, and it's working. Polls are going up. As it works more and more, we could get closer to a war. It gets, you know, the last time somebody I heard anything was in the 30s, the amount of American people who believe that was a threat, whereas they never really got worried about the bomb. So it was a tactical, there's been some tactical decisions made in Washington, which is to change the threat. They still talk about nukes, but they also talk about the Iranians killing more boys. That does play. And as it goes, I wrote most recently, they've changed the targeting. make it more limited. They're trying to get the Brits involved. The Brits are a little bit interested. The Brits, who knows what really goes on? Who knows what's really going on with the French? Except I can tell you that Sarkozy has an awful lot of neoconservative elements in his government, which may or may not mean anything. It's hard to play. It's hard to know where he stands. My guess is he's told us informally he's against the bombing. He won't fight it if it happens because he doesn't like the Iranians at all. The French don't like him at all. They feel, well, like most of the Europeans feel, that the Iranians have been playing with us and diddling with us and not been straight. I don't know whether that justifies an air war, but it may.
From Dublin, this is the 2007 Amnesty International Lecture, delivered October 24, 2007. Veteran journalist Seymour Hersh is describing U.S. intentions for Iran and the Middle East.
I'm asked all the time. I've never said it's going to happen. I've written six or seven stories in the New Yorker have all been about the planning. And with all due respect, Provost, it's not contingency. It's gone beyond it. It's what they call operational planning. We actually have the cruise missiles, our target. All the planes have their target. We've done all the work to target specific targets. The one goal would be to decapitate the Revolutionary Guards. This is new thinking. We'll hit their barracks. We'll hit their homes. We will knock out the leadership of the Revolutionary Guard, although some of you know something about the Iranians know the Revolutionary Guard are very 125,000, 150,000 strong, very mixed. There was one poll that showed that more 53%, there was a poll done recently in the last year or two inside Iran, 53% were favored détente. There are certainly fringe elements. There are many elements who would love a war. There's many elements who would not. They're involved in business. They're involved in commerce. It's a different structure than we have here in the West. It's by far. So my guess is, I don't know. It could be he's 12 hours away. He can do it 12 hours away now. He could wake up one morning and not like the way he combed his hair or the way it looks and say, let's go. You know, when Nixon was around, I used to always have this joke. Nixon was known as somebody, this is terrible to say, but unfortunately it's true, who would occasionally take a whack at his wife. And it was one of the big covered-up stories. It's been written about a little bit, not very much, but it's been written about a lot, and in a few obscure places anyway. And so I always used to joke that we invaded Cambodia because he went looking for Pat one night after he had three martinis and couldn't find her, so he bombed Cambodia instead with very deleterious results. Anyway, I don't know. It seems to me it's pretty simple about Iran. We're not doing so well in the two wars we're in. Why go into a third one? But that's neither here nor there. So I don't know what's going to happen. All I know is it's not going to be rational when it does happen. And the consequences are going to be asymmetrical. I think the Iranians will not hit Israel, will not hit America. They will just pour everything they have into the oil and gas stuff in the Gulf and double the price of oil within a day. Take out 40% of the world's oil for us. Bam, bam. Just like that. The Navy's done studies in which they're afraid they would lose a carrier. So let me just, two more things to get out of here, and we'll do questions. And, you know, lots of laughs, huh? So let me tell you two stories about, go from the macro. Let's go from macro to micro. Tell you two quick stories. The My Lai massacre was, and here's where there's a lot of parallels with Iraq in this. In Vietnam, we went to war against a culture we didn't understand, against an enemy we didn't see. And what would happen is troops would get into combat and go there and be puffed up, full of fighting. They were fighting communists. And what happened, under Robert McNamara, who you may think the world of him, but I covered that building. I covered the Pentagon during the war, and I stayed with him a long time. And he's basically a psychotic liar because... sociopathic. He has no idea when he lies. It's just sort of ingrained. I don't think he's capable really dealing with what he's been responsible for along with a lot of other people. Flash forward 35 years. I'm doing Abu Ghraib. And I'm at now with the New Yorker, which is very exalted with elaborate checking procedures. And I get this great story, this great story with this wonderful general who did a report that was dazzling. We do the story, and I keep on going because I know this comes from on high. Again, heuristically, you don't do what we're doing unless it's on high. Too many people knew. There were too many people at Abu Ghraib. Too many people watched what was going on. This humiliation. It's all part of breaking down prisoners. Really what it was part of, the idea was we had nobody inside. And what you want to do is you want to get some of these young males we captured. We want to put them in a position where we photograph them nude. In the Quran, it says twice. You cannot show a nude, man cannot show his nudity to another man, let alone to, you know, you cannot do it. You go to any sports club in Cairo, private showers. If there's a collective shower in the sports club, everybody wears shorts. And a Westerner, you wear shorts out of just respect for their beliefs. And so the idea was, I think, the intellectual idea is we were going to break down and get incriminating evidence on some of these guys and send them back home and tell them to find the insurgency and join it and then tell us what's going on, or we'll show these parents to their schoolmates and the woman in the neighborhood, and they'll be ruined forever, which they would be given the mores. You know, that's a society that operates on shame. We operate here on guilt. You know, it's, but whatever. That may have been the idea. It's all lost in what happened. So I'm doing this story, and I'm convinced Rummy's involved. I'm convinced it goes to the top. I have a lot of reason to be convinced. You get in this funny situation. I have paper I can't use because the people that gave it to me would be burned forever. So I can't do it. But I know where it goes. Anyway, I'm on a radio talk show, charging away, I'm on an NPR, National Public Radio, national show like you have here. You're very fine. You have this, the Irish radio is great. A woman calls up on this. She said, I have a child that was in the unit that did all this bad stuff, and nobody will talk to me. I tried to call the government. They won't talk to me, and there's all sorts of problems. I went to the New York Times. Nobody returns the phone call. So I just said on the air, one of those things you just do, I said, got a pencil? Figure people listening to talk radio in the afternoon, aren't sitting there at a typewriter or a computer, and I gave her my phone number. And sure enough, I got not that many crank calls. There were a lot of calls, people wanting my number, but of course nobody gave it out in the various stations. This was on all over the American network for NPR, National Public Radio. And a couple of days later, she called me, and I scoot up to where she is, somewhere in Northeast America. And she is a very devout Catholic who supported the war totally. She had a child. There was a child involved. I'm going to fudge. But it's just fudging, just for the sake of fudging. I could say everything, but it wouldn't matter here, but I just do it. There was a child involved who'd been in the unit that was doing the horrible stuff and had come home early. They sent the unit home early, maybe not, I don't know. And the child, before the stories came out, nobody knew anything. She's in a unit, the child comes home, she's in the Army Reserve, and she's in a military police unit. She's basically part of a group. And this is lower middle class America, and what the child was doing was getting extra money, maybe for a hairdo or to go to beauty school or what. Not that they're not as bright as anybody else, but they were totally disadvantaged, the people in this particular unit. They came from rural West Virginia area. And one of the people with the thumbs up and thumbs down was the night manager of a pizza parlor. They were all reservists called to active duty for the war, and they initially were directing traffic in Baghdad, and they were reassigned, given a couple weeks training, and sent to this most sophisticated, complicated prison, Abu Ghraib, which had incredible stigma. It was the torture prison for Saddam, which we kept for some reason, only, you know, dumber than dumb. And so she'd come home early. The mother couldn't figure out what was going on. A changed person. She had been married before she left. She came home, left her husband, left the family, stopped talking, moved to another house, and was inconsolable. Just completely in severe black depression, really. That wasn't a word that she would use. But she just disappeared, moved, had a different job. And so I show up, and here's the story. Nobody knew what was going on. She came back about a month and a half before the stories broke about her unit. It was her unit that she had been in. And this woman took a newspaper. When the first stories came out, it was huge. The pictures of the guy in the mask and, you know, standing up in the chair. And she went to knocked on the door, and the daughter answered the door and slammed it when she showed her the picture. Is this it? Is this what happened? So then she tried to talk to people in the government. Nobody would talk to her. And she went to the media, and nobody talked to her, because here's what she did. All the kids in combat duty in Iraq, all of, I'm sure the British soldiers too. I don't know if Irish soldiers were there. I don't think so. The British soldiers, all one of the things, because Iraq is so unfun, no R&R, everybody brings a DVD player. They all manage, even the poorest of the family manage to glom onto something that they can watch movies and play war games in the off time. And that's what they do. Everybody had a DV player. And when the child came home, right away, before all this stuff broke, before she began acting out, she left a computer. And it was at this point, the woman said she decided to look at the computer. I've told her, I tease her a lot about the unconscious and Freud. She says, absolutely not. She needed another computer for her office. It had nothing to do with anything. I don't believe it. I think she wanted to see what was in the computer. She opened up the computer and began deleting files. She was going to take it to her office. She was a salesperson. Began deleting files. And there was a file marked Iraq. And she hits this button, and out pours 80 pictures of a naked man standing in front of prison bars, hand behind his head. You'll remember this photograph. Two Belgian shepherds. We call them wrongly German shepherds, for which the New Yorker got 7,000 letters, I'm sure. Two Belgian shepherds 3 feet away, snarling at him, foaming, you know, ready to go. And we published the one photograph of the man standing there, not even protecting his private parts. He had to keep his hand behind his head. I'm sure some of you remember it. It was just a famous photograph. But here's what the sequence was. In the sequence, the dogs were let loose at him. And he was bitten in a terrible place, and there was blood all over. And they ended with some hand trying to hand sew the stitches. No doctor, just one of the people, some soldier trying to sew it up. And it was, the New Yorker's position is, you can't, it wasn't about protecting anybody, it's how much can you humiliate the Arab. And the army's been beaten to death already in this story. It's not a question of protecting. We only ran the one photograph. And it was just a nightmare. So she wanted me to have this. We ended up doing the right thing. We got permission from her, and we got her, I'm sure she got her into some sort of immediate treatment because she was really at the edge. So we became friends, I and this woman, because she was an amazing, amazing gutsy lady. She had there had been a divorce, and she had a boyfriend that didn't want to do any of this, and she was sort of, she just did the right thing. She was just, the morality was great. Year go by. I'm giving a speech somewhere in the area, and I take her for dinner, and she tells me this story that she said she hadn't told me. She said that when the kid came back, moved away, a beautiful child, she said, left her husband, every weekend she began to get tattooed. And she would get bigger and bigger and larger tattoos. Eventually, all her body was tattooed up to the neck. It was, she said, again, quote unquote, as if she was trying to change her skin. So what I posit is this, as bad as it is, and I'm not even talking about the incredible destruction to Iraqi society and the chaos and deaths and the psychological damage of young children living the last 6 years, not only having to put up with Saddam, but having to put up with us for the last 3-4 years of whatever insanity we do. We in America are going to really be paid back for all of this. We have about 1.5 million troops circulating through there. And I'm telling you right now, some of you know what Ambien is. It's 2 or 3 Ambien for the kids to get through the night, any of them. We are going to pay dearly. So we haven't begun to see, let alone World War III, macro, in the micro level, it's going to be devastating. And it's just, so you just sit here and it's just an overwhelming sadness, and we can wait, we can count, but he's going to be president until noon on January 20th, 2009. And until then, I'm not breathing easily. Let's do questions, and I'm sorry it took so long.
That was award-winning journalist Seymour Hersh speaking at the Amnesty International Annual Lecture in Dublin on October 24, 2007. The speech was edited for radio. Unfortunately, to fit a one-hour format, a recounting of the My Lai massacre of Vietnamese villagers in March 1968 was removed. That story is available elsewhere from the historical record thanks to Seymour Hersh, who reported it. He also revealed the torture of Iraqis at the American-run Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. A full version of this speech, plus a further hour-long question and answer period, is available online at www.radioforall.net. That is radio, the number 4, .net.